this little yellow pamphlet before they come into the meeting. Because on it you will find the time of the meetings and everything else you would want to know on what we meet for in this space. So you see today, the day is the 21st of October, and we're here to discuss the great founders of the Theosophical movement. Doors opened at 10:30, we begin promptly at 11 and be over at noon. Now during the week we meet on a Wednesday night, and the doors open at 5:30, so you can come into the library from 5:30 to 7:30 with 15 minutes before the meeting begins. The librarian and the volunteer at the desk can give you the details about the building, books you might buy, etc., etc., and etc. The topic for today, the 21st, great founders of the Theosophical movement. And the objects of the Theosophical movement is to form the nucleus of a universal brotherhood of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, caste, or color. The study of ancient and modern religions, philosophies, and sciences, and the demonstration of the importance of such study and the investigation of the unexplained laws of nature and the psychical powers latent in man. So these words that you hear, ask questions. Everybody is invited to ask questions, and if they have comments, they make them, because this is a joint effort, and it's a cooperative effort. No names, no personalities are involved, and everybody is invited to participate, no matter their background. On this yellow pamphlet, you'll find other small details that will be of interest to you. But we want to read the Declaration because there's so many things in it that will be valuable for you. We printed it out so it's a little bit larger to read. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy without professing attachment to any Theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy, and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among Theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim and purpose and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea among Theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as Theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. As was said, it's imperative that you get one of these. Some of us have these going back 20 or 30 years, because on each page there's a gem of information.
But we're not going to hurt them if they don't take it, right?
No, no, okay. But look what they'll be missing. Okay, the reading for this morning is collated from the series Ancient Landmarks in magazine Theosophy 14. Please, you'll be hearing words, but we should remember the words. They are important. Ancient Landmarks. The secret doctrine is the common property of the countless millions of men born under various climates and times with which history refuses to deal. The birth and evolution of the sacred science of the past are lost in the very night of time. In every age, under every condition of civilization and knowledge, the educated classes of every nation made themselves the more or less faithful echoes of one identical system and its fundamental traditions. So many streams of the same water must have had a common source from which they started. What was this source? It is by those shadows of the hoary past and their fantastic silhouettes on the external screen of every religion and philosophy that we can, by checking them as we go along and comparing them, trace out finally the body that produced them. There must be truth and fact in that which every people of antiquity accepted and made the foundation of its religions and its faith. The language of the soul, and therefore the soul of all languages, is symbol. That language is universal. Like the incarnating ego in man, it embodies itself in many forms: religions, philosophies, sciences. All branches of knowledge spring from the wisdom religion, which has for its vehicle this ancient universal language. The wisdom religion, or theosophy, is the drama of the unfoldment of the one life, the springing forth of the many lives from the one life, and the orderly procession of the many as the kingdoms of nature, till they re-become one. These form the contents of the record of the masters, and that is theosophy. Every stage of that long pilgrimage is described in symbols, and among them, that of the adept teacher, whose compassion manifests in practical sacrifice and makes him incarnate in a body of flesh and blood. There is a long line of divine incarnations. All religions bear witness to the fact.
So, we think if you got any of the gist of that reading, you realize why our subject cannot be answered. Who are the great founders of the theosophical movement? Well, that depends. What do you understand by the term the theosophical movement? If you think it means what we are studying right now, which is true, then the great founders, of course, were HPB and Judge. But that isn't where theosophy started. And that isn't what the theosophical movement is, our effort here and now today. Theosophy is divine wisdom, ancient wisdom, or the ancient wisdom religion. Its true founders and true source we will never know the names of. They were... We hate our language. We're sure in Sanskrit it could be detailed beautifully, but they were great beings. Our language says, archangels. They were beings of power and wisdom who incarnated on this earth for only one purpose, and that was to educate, elevate, instruct infant humanity. Now, if you want to follow this out throughout the philosophy, you're only going to find hints dropped here and there. We'll read a few of them. Occult science has its changeless traditions from prehistoric times. It may err in particulars. It can never become guilty of a mistake in questions of universal laws, simply because that science, justly referred to by philosophy as the divine, was born on higher planes and was brought on earth by beings who were wiser than man will be, even in the seventh race of the seventh round. We begin then to get a glimpse of the sacrifice that these beings have made. This was from the Secret Doctrine, and it tells us that these beings must have been elevated and initiated in higher realms beyond which we could even reach now, yet they come to assist us. Again from the Secret Doctrine, we believe in races of beings other than our own, in dynasties of divine beings, those kings and instructors of the third race in arts and sciences. For that race at that time, and never forget, we are part of every race we speak of. We developed in the third race. And in that race, we were all of one lip, of one tongue. So it was complete understanding between all. Universal tradition shows primitive man living for ages together with his creators and instructors. And it is said that because of that intimacy, that we knew we were spiritual, that we knew our source, and that we recognized the identity of that within every other part of life. Therefore, we can say it was golden. But it was golden because we were innocent. A child is innocent. Then give him the wrong education, and where is that innocence? It's buried or lost. So it was what is called infant humanity. From the beginning, from the very beginning in time and space, the mysteries of nature were recorded by the pupils of those now invisible heavenly men in geometric figures and symbols. And the keys to that passed from one generation of wise men to another. In other words, this theosophy or divine wisdom was passed from one to another, from those who possessed it to those who were capable of learning and understanding it. And it is they who have kept records in crypt and temple, who have possessed the knowledge within themselves and also kept the record of it for us for the future. From Manu, Thought Hermes, Enoch, down to Plato, all tell us of seven divine dynasties. Gods who descend from their celestial abode, teaching mankind astronomy, architecture, and all the other sciences. These beings appear first as gods and creators. Then they merge to finally come forth as divine kings and rulers. It makes you begin to understand Mr. Judge's statement in the ocean. Mankind has never been without a friend. When these wise beings left the scene, as you have to do, if you don't leave children to grow and learn on their own, they never will grow and learn. So they retired from the scene, but the wisdom remained. And kings and adepts worked within the people to keep these ideas alive. So we have all these various religions, which no adept or initiate ever started as a religion, but it was as a statement of universal laws and principles. And over time, these get distorted or reworked into absolute rules or dogma or rites and rituals. But underneath, if we can uncover it, The truths are there in every religion and philosophy. The wisdom religion was ever one, and being the last word of possible human knowledge was carefully preserved among the initiates of every country, which is one of the reasons we are told to investigate and examine the religions and philosophies of every nation, because its basis is one and the same, and we have to, for ourselves, uncover that. We have to prove it to ourselves that this really is one stream of thought. And in spite of the distortions, we can get to the truth. And then this very famous quote, and we have put out on the usher's table a copy of The Secret Doctrine, Volume 1, 272-5, and on some of the symbols. The secret doctrine is the accumulated wisdom of the ages, and its cosmogony alone is the most stupendous and elaborate system. It is useless to say that the system in question is no fancy of one or several isolated individuals, that it is the uninterrupted record covering thousands of generations of seers. But here we go again to the difficulty of this question. Yes, covering thousands of generations of seers of our fifth race. But if we want the true figure, we have to go back to what we are told, that as thinkers, we have been incarnating into the human form on this globe for 18 million years. Now, the truth of what was given and presented to humanity has not changed. So it is older than the thousands of generations and seers. But what happened? We know it gets very interesting once humans get to start making choices and using their will. It is from the fourth race, that would be the Atlantean race, that the early Aryans got their knowledge of physiology, psychology, anthropology, mechanics, and mathematics. So from the third race, that infant humanity's wisdom and knowledge, which is impacted in us, we may use it completely incorrectly, but we still use it. Every human has certain intrinsic ideals, honesty, fairness, justice. We think the best example of distortion is brotherhood. Brotherhood is at the basis of every human being's heart and thinking. But my idea of brotherhood might be people that look like me, people that vote like me, people that think like me, people who worship like me. I will be very brotherly and loyal to them, but anybody else is beyond the pale. Well, it's still brotherhood, but it is a distortion. So all these ancient ideas and ideals, wisdom, impacted within us remains. We have just covered it up with our coloring, our use of, our prejudice for and against. So we inherited, we here now in the fifth race, from ourselves as Atlanteans, many, many wonderful things. All we have to do is go look in any city in the United States and Dubai. Just let your eyes go up. Atlanteans are busy building things everywhere. So we have all of this. You know, we remember being staggered by the realization that every culture, every civilization, even the smallest little element of it, has a particular food source that represents a complete expression of all of the amino acids in the cheapest form. In this country, it's beans and rice, and in this country, it's another grain with another bean. Everywhere. Now, how could that be across the world that everyone has this inexpensive ability to survive very well if it were not given to us, if we were not instructed in it? How could it have traveled across the world and be ancient knowledge? It doesn't make any sense. And we think there are many things we could realize that way, that the only way it's possible that everyone has this particular wisdom is if it was given to us. For long ages, the wise men of the fifth race, ours, of the stock saved and rescued from the last cataclysm and shifting of continents, had passed their lives in learning, not teaching. And this is the result that we have now. The learning, teaching, checking, verifying, experiencing, growing is what brought forth the cycle that we now have, the Theosophical movement. The period beginning with Buddha and Pythagoras at the one end, and the Neoplatonists and Gnostics at the other, is the only focus left in history wherein converge for the last time the bright rays of light streaming from the eons of time gone by, unobscured by the hand of bigotry and fanaticism. Beginning with Buddha and Pythagoras and ending with the Neoplatonists and Gnostics. We think almost all students realize it was the murder of the philosopher Hypatia in 415 that created the Dark Ages for humanity. However, many don't realize that during the 8th and 9th centuries, while the West was in the Dark Ages, ignorance and sloth and despicable, desperate conditions, four companions appeared in the Muhammad world. Two of them gave expression to the Neoplatonic tradition in the 8th century, Al-Kindi and Al-Farabi. And in the 9th, two that continued the Hermetic line of the Theosophical teachings, Geber, and Razis, R-H-A-Z-E-S. Geber is acknowledged as the man who reintroduced the science of chemistry, alchemy, into Europe. Razis, whose real name was Abu Bekr Arasi, devoted his life to working out correspondences. His methods of medical study became the basis in all Arab universities and were considered as the final authority in medicine until the time of Paracelsus. So we often overlook our debt to the world of Islam and the thinkers who worked there, who kept the light of wisdom shining and alive. In our time, Ireland, it is a tradition among occultists in general and taught as an historical fact in occult philosophy that what is now Ireland was once upon a time the abode of the Atlanteans, emigrants from the submerged island mentioned by Plato. Of all the British Isles, Ireland is the most ancient by several thousands of years. The masters and keepers of the old science claim to have preserved genuine records. So in one way, we have no idea who the founders and the workers of the Theosophical movement are. We know we're all grateful to Thomas Paine. If you stop and think about the fact that we're sitting here freely expressing these radical ideas in what some people consider a Christian country, which it isn't, we forget the debt we owe to someone like Thomas Paine, who did pay a terrific price for sharing what he knew. And he also gave credit to those great adepts in declaring that what he wrote came to him fully blown in his mind. All he had to do was transcribe it. It wasn't, and he admitted it, it wasn't his thinking, his planning. It was his words, but the ideas came to him fully expressed. And if you think about how peculiar it is that our Declaration and our Constitution is not religious, is not Christian, why is that a surprise? Well, if you think about it, this was a country or a colony established by Puritans. You couldn't find a more rigid thinking of what must be done, what must not be done, unless you went to some islands in the Upper Hebrides of Scotland where you're not even allowed to plant flowers. It was amazing that these thinkers were able to produce a document that we live by and succeed by that had no religious foundation. We know he called himself a deist, as did most of those who were part of the early founding of this country. And he said, quote, "My mind is my church. Churches are human inventions set up to enslave mankind and monopolize power and profit." Becomes easy to see why he was ostracized. But in 1797, when he had been sent by this country to Paris, he founded an ethical society called Theophilanthropists, Adorers of God and Friends of Man. And he read from the ethical teachings of Bible, Greek, Hindu, and the Chinese in order to instruct in this society that he founded. So we are the beneficiaries of many founders, many workers, but if we're going to talk about the great founders, we have to go as far back as we can mentally and recognize those who are nameless. And Mr. Judge calls them the nannies. And he says that there is a certain object for our general work. It is to start up a new force, a new current in the world, whereby great and long gone nannies or wise ones will be attracted back to incarnate among us here and now. So the work that we do is to present that reflection of this divine wisdom wherever it can be found, whether from the teachings of Krishna or Buddha or Christ, wherever it is found, to offer it freely, to be the companions, because the masters cannot incarnate in the midst of this pollution. The pollution is caused by us. We can therefore work within it. But without us, the masters have no voice except what is recorded. And as we all know, people will turn to wisdom when they're desperate. Well, the times are pretty desperate, but if we don't hold up the light of wisdom, it can't be found. That, in a way, makes us founders as well. Isn't that odd? We're sure you have questions. Yes.
We read an interesting statement by Mr. Judge yesterday that said that when there are earthquakes, it means that a great soul
has incarnated.
We've had a lot of earthquakes in the last.
Too bad they're all little
years.
Kids at this point,
well,
right?
It's all right.
Yeah. Yes, it is all right because they will grow up. It's an interesting thing when you think about it. It must be that incarnation sets up a certain magnetic force that the earth responds to. Yes, we thought the same thing. Yes. Yes.
I get caught up truly where we are in such infants. I mean, what are we really doing here? I mean, part of me feels that there's something that's pioneering about us, that we're learning stuff that mm-hmm. that has not been learned. But then again, if there are these beings which are so far above us that know everything that we can possibly know, what's the purpose?
Well, I suppose you could ask that of parents of a newborn. You know everything that child could possibly ever know. What's the point of having a child? We are not infant humanity at this point. Unfortunately, we're teenage humanity. We're in the midst of struggling and trying to learn to control things. But at the same time, if you turn to the Bible, you find a very strange thing in Genesis where the Elohim, even though we're supposed to be reflecting on this one God, you have the Elohim, divine beings, who are expressing resentment. Here are these humans, and they are going to be greater than us. They didn't like that. Well, how can what is newly formed be greater than what is already wise? And the answer is, you cannot, unless you have the choice to do wrong instead of right, to do evil instead of good, unless you have the freedom to will and choose, you cannot be greater than a God. They cannot will or choose. They have their powers intact, but they cannot choose to act other than as a divine being. We can. It's also the expression in the Bible, there's more rejoicing over the return of one sinner than 100 good men, because the sinner knows what he is giving up, what he is not going to do anymore. And the good can be good passively because they're afraid or they're shy or they're timid. So it isn't that we can't learn more than the highest being. It's that in this period of evolution, we can only learn to a certain limit. But once we have done that, we then stand ready to begin in the next higher limit. There is no limit to the possibilities. Only, just like saying, if you go to med school, you can only learn what the teachers have to teach you. You cannot go beyond them. But if you graduate from there and you go on to a specialty, yes, you can go on. Did that help at all?
Immensely.
Oh, okay, because you didn't look like it did. And behind you, there was an earlier response. Yes. Oh, yes.
Could part of it also be that these great wise beings referred to were not created that way?
Right.
By a supreme being,
exactly.
But at one point were in our stage and had to evolve to that condition.
Yes, it's that what you know you can't unknow. What you learn you have earned. You have done it. So when we speak of a being like Pythagoras or Buddha or Plato, we are talking about a human being who put forth the effort to learn these principles and laws, then to apply them and to grow and change and force themselves. This is what, really, theosophy is forced evolution. We are taking the ideas and enforcing them on our own lower nature, which is lower because it's in contrast to the spiritual being that we are. So every great being was in a human form on some planet at some time and learned from that. Yes?
In some ways, isn't a historical person almost like a latitude and longitude
mm-hmm.
point where
mm-hmm.
that collectivity of wisdom has shined through for a time? So that these great beings, as part of a collectivity, may be unknowable in a certain way, but we just use the personality or the personage
as a focus,
it.
Right. The, you know, it's like in the Secret Doctrine, it tells us that every city is built on top of an ancient city because it's a magnetic attraction. In Great Britain, they talk about the ley lines, where all the standing stones lay, L-E-Y lines in Great Britain. All of the standing stones are supposedly along these lines of magnetic influence. There have also been studies of the pyramids that show that there's a, even in Central and South America, that there's a direct magnetic relationship between two of them, no matter how far apart they are. So that is true on every level. If we could but realize that there is a line of teachers, it's called the Guru Paramparam chain, and it touches all the way down to a human teacher. That's part of that same principle. And as we respect those who teach us, so we get more and more opportunity. We're magnetically drawn to the very things. Yes?
That last idea was very interesting because mm-hmm. it brought me back to when I was looking at the Rembrandt and Jesus exhibit. And they would talk about how he looked so sad or whatever. And everything that I saw, I mean, Rembrandt I look at as a very evolved painter mm-hmm. as well. So somebody who I trust what he was able to capture. Mm-hmm. And all I could see was emptiness. Literally, there was nothing there. There was blank eyes. And there's a part of me that thinks that these highly evolved beings are not human. They are nothing. They are just something through which some sort of thing can come through. So I don't know if that has any relevance, but that's just something that a connection that just happens.
Well, I would think that emptiness is not the word. I would think it's the way a doctor looks at a patient who has a certain condition. There's a detachment from the personality of the patient and that condition, and or the fact that it's painful or life-threatening. There is a detachment so they can deal with it without all these other distractions. That's not emptiness. We have the same thing with a teacher and a student. If a teacher were to feel the frustration that the student is feeling, they couldn't get around it or beyond it. Instead, they use their knowledge to realize how they learned something, and they offer it. It's not emptiness. It's empathy. If in Rembrandt's rendering, he rendered it that way, it might be how he sees it. But we think to overcome that is to look at what other artists may have done, but equally to look at what individual teachers said. What did the Buddha say? Look within, thou art Buddha. He didn't say, I am not a human, I am empty, I am void of all this. He said, your problem is your desires. We cut out a little thing from the paper. We think it might be the Dalai Lama who said it. Someone came to the Buddha and said, I want happiness. And the Buddha said, forget the I. Forget the want. And you're left with happiness.
And that's emptiness.
Is it emptiness?
Well, I look at emptiness as a positive thing.
Well. Okay, no, but yeah, we understand what you mean, but it's not, if it's emptiness, it's an emptiness that's full of something. Yes.
Well, the I there that is to be forgotten is the personal I, mm-hmm. and the wants are the personal desires, which leaves a lot, as
right.
was indicated, that leaves the individuality and the higher aspirations, which
are identical to the higher beings. We tend to, as individuals struggling with these ideas, we tend to separate ourselves from wisdom. It's something, and that's partly the way we have been taught. You have to get a certain grade, you have to make a certain level, and then you'll have this. And theosophy says it's the opposite. You have to do unmake what you think you know now in order to allow what you really are as a spiritual being to come through. You are the possessor of universal wisdom. You're a ray of universal mind. And what interferes is the way you use your own mind. Yes?
The term founders, though, is admittedly very confusing because in the English language, we tend to equate it with the beginning of some institution or country or organization. But from what was stated, if the wisdom is eternal, there can only be a time when an individual maybe sets a keynote and expresses an aspect of that wisdom. They don't actually found it, per se.
But still we refer to it that way.
Yes.
Because our language is pathetic. And it's pathetic because we don't have an interest in these ideas as a people. You stop and think about all the terms that are created for advertising. That's what we're interested in, acquisition and facades and prestige. And it should truly be called the expression of what was already there. Because even these great beings did not invent any of this. They merely represented what was known of old. And how will we change it as humans? If we learn something and learn it well, we're then able to put it into our words and our feeling, which doesn't change the truth, but it adds to it. It adds to the color. Yes.
So when we see something like the release of the new Jeffersonian Bible,
right,
where we've got a copy
with his
of editing and commentary from that thinker, what we're looking at is the trace evidence of this process that you're referring to, isn't it?
Yes. And then there's also his letters to his nephew, one of which he said, "Don't believe in God. Just don't. It interferes with everything. But act as though you believed in God." In other words, live up to your highest, but don't be dependent on anything outside of you. Jefferson Washington, if you ever get a chance, read the Treaty of Tripoli. We think it had to do with pirates on the Barbary Coast, and we think John Adams was president at the time. But George Washington wrote a letter to, what would it be, the Shah of something, and saying, "No, please understand, America is not a Christian country, and we have no argument with the Muslimmen, the Mohammedans." So we had, from our founding, an understanding of true brotherhood in the sense of freedoms, and we are the beneficiaries of that. Yes?
Well, we heard the term analogy and correspondence.
Mm-hmm.
And this morning we were looking at the first page of a mathematics book.
You were looking at what?
First page of a book on mathematics. And they were mentioning some of those founders that you spoke about. And in there was a simple formula using symbols. 2x equals, no, 2 times x equals 0.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. You lost me.
Without anybody trying to give an answer, but here's what I think of where I am. Now, we have to come up with something so that statement is proven to be true or false. And we think that those teachers came, those great beings, impressing our mind and said, and gave us symbols to use to come to a conclusion so that we too will be able to see the truth. But we have to think, whereas our modern education gives us a set of things, memorize them, and you're back.
We think, if we go back to Pythagoras, we think it was Pythagoras who took the one central term, the muse, and that's what education was, and then broke it down into music, geometry, algebra, all of the various specialties of it. But we don't even want to think 2 times x equals 0. We're lost. Yes.
But the whole idea is that we don't think. We want someone to tell us to do this. We want to. We hear about great beings, and that they would come and lead us by the hand.
Ah, no! What they did was come and give us the basics, and from the basics you can move forward. Why are we waiting? We're waiting because we're the ones who created the religions that we are hampered by. We sit and we wait to be told what to do. We wait to be saved by someone outside of us. And we like it that way. We don't want the responsibility for our own growth. And yet that is the only way that the universe works. Everything comes from within outward. So waiting is not going to do anything. Yes?
Earlier it was mentioned that theosophy is almost this process of remembering, of unknowing. What role does wonder, reverence in the mystery play in this process?
That's wonderful. Reverence and mystery, the joy of, you know, the word enthusiasm. Are you aware of its source? What does it mean? It means entheos, with God. Enthusiasm means you are on fire with that principle inside yourself. Reverence, joy in the mystery. You know, if we would just take a few moments every day to appreciate the wonders all around us, sit down and watch your hand for a while and think what it would be like if it were different and how amazing it is, how you can use it. Think about really stupid things, like how is it you can blow on a cup of tea to cool it, and you can blow on your hands to warm them. Excuse me? There are a million and one things that don't make any sense unless you take up the mystery and the joy of it. We are beings of power. We had called on the gentleman behind you.
Well, we're confused by one or two things. We understand the whole guru.
It's a little hard to hear you.
We understand the whole guru parampara chain, and on the way up, obviously, infinitum, and each step up is a more highly developed mind being. But the bit about the archangels and the philosophies, corresponding words, the Johans, we understand that to be, you know, the differentiations in cosmology, not thinking, acting beings, but forces of nature, and our understanding is the reason why man, in so many words, is greater than the angels, is actually, on the one hand, yes, they can't do anything other than fulfill perfect law, but also because everything that man, the constituents that man is comprised of, is from all 7 hierarchies of the angels. And so we are the synthesis of the substance of all the angels, and therefore can rise above any one or all of them.
No, that's perfectly so, according to the philosophy. Okay. But equally, the Dihan Shohans, the what is called the archangels elsewhere, actually do, in the beginning of the the incarnation of the thinkers. Yes, in the third root race, when the thinkers incarnate into the ready form, they actually incarnate. Now, we're not told. That's why we read from so many different sources. All we're given is a sentence or two, divine ancient beings. But they actually instructed us, so they had to make contact. If we were ethereal, they were ethereal.
And really, this is in a question form or a suggestion form. We're wondering, is it, like, are we thinking the ocean? It says that they were men who were there who had been perfected in previous periods of evolution, so men alone, that guru power and power chain, as opposed to angelic beings who, I don't know that they ever were.
But, you know, what's really funny, and here we go again, it's language. We are angelic beings. We come from inner space, from a line of solar beings. We can't think of any of those things as separate from us, just as you said, more advanced in control of their principles and their natures. So they did incarnate, whether you want to consider it a human form or not, in order to make contact. You can't evolve until you involve. You had your hand.
It's partly to carry on from that, but also from the reading of one of the excerpts from The Secret Doctor. It said, the symbol of the adept sacrificing and incarnating, we don't remember the exact words, why is that referred to as a symbol and not an exact fact? We're confused by that, a reference to that as a symbol.
We don't really know for sure what the statement was.
It was from one of the readings there.
Right. Well, I'm sorry, I can't find it, but an adept is both a reality and a symbol. A symbol to us as something to recognize as a goal, as a purpose. And yet, they are also a reality. The expression is, they are ideals and they are facts. And we don't have it available right now. Unless you own Magazine Theosophy, then you can look up the series Ancient Landmarks and Great Theosophists. But we do have Xerox copies of them for sale, but they won't be here till Wednesday. In there, you can trace the actual reality of these symbols who were living men. Yes? Yes?
Well, we wish we could refer to
it. Yeah, I do too.
But we think that it means that all the legends or the stories of an individual or an adept choosing to incarnate to save humanity is a symbol, because that individuality is not acting on their own individual free will. They, in a sense, are so identified with the universal and with law and with all those intelligences. They are incarnating as representatives, in fact, of that, but not the symbol, though, makes it sound as though it's an individual personage.
Yes?
To go along with that, we know in the ocean talks somewhere about that these higher beings have been or will be human. So how can they be higher beings if they haven't been human yet?
Why don't you pick up The Secret Doctrine and read it? We know you've read it. The fact is that we're kind of splitting hairs. because it speaks of beings, not necessarily those great beings who came to infant humanity. All of life either has been or will be man. Why? Because it is only in the human stage where the soul has spirit and matter meeting in their mind. And once that happens, you can choose and will. You can't will and choose if you're being representative of universal principles. You are acting on the basis of collective intelligence. So all expressions of spirit will be human at some point. We are there right now. Yes?
Help me with this. What you're describing is the experience and the synthesis of mind and spirit and matter, not necessarily a particular kind of human form.
Right. Right. It is said that there is, quote, humanity on every man-bearing planet. But we wouldn't recognize it. As a matter of fact, there are so many wonderful pinches to the mind in the philosophy. And one of them is that you cannot even imagine something unless it is in universal mind. You can't, because you are an expression of it. And when she said this to someone, the person responded, "You mean, if I picture a tower with a head on top?" She said, "You couldn't think of it if it didn't exist." So who knows? Maybe that's the way they are on Venus or Mars. Who knows? It doesn't matter. What matters is our ability to take what we learn and use it to the benefit of life instead of to ourselves. This is a wonderful statement by HPB. Theosophy is divine knowledge, and knowledge is truth. Every true fact, every sincere word, are thus part and parcel of theosophy. And remember, when we say theosophy, what we have in the books is a partial expression. It is the secret doctrine in part. We have to earn the rest. One who is skilled in divine alchemy, or even approximately blessed with the gift of the perception of truth, will find and extract from theosophy, will extract it from an erroneous as much as from a correct statement. However small the particle of gold lost in a ton of rubbish, it is the noble metal still, and worthy of being dug out, even at the price of some extra trouble. The gold is there in all the sciences, religions, philosophies, but first we need to know the basics of what it is we're looking for. And for those, we always return to a brief statement of the fundamentals. If it doesn't describe the unity of all life, if it leaves anyone or anything out, it's not theosophy. If it doesn't describe a universe of law, of cause and effect on every plane, it isn't theosophy. If it doesn't describe an opportunity for learning and growth for all life, it isn't theosophy. Meeting is adjourned.